Well, I was going to do a PowerPoint presentation. I had it all set, and somebody must have touched something, or the gods are not shining on me because it just disappeared. It was there. I didn't touch anything, and it disappeared. It says no signal. I think it has to do with the... I apologize. If you'll bear with me for 1 minute... It'll come back.
Thank you.
No signal.
Okay. So, first, I would very much like to thank Gunther Ullmann for inviting me to participate and to help organize this meeting, and for all of the wonderful meetings that he's invited me to, and for the opportunity to learn so much interesting stuff from the rest of you. And I would especially like to thank John Schottland, who's worked very hard to do a lot of the organization. The work I'll talk about, electrical impedance tomography, is done in collaboration with Jonathan Newell and Gary Saulnier. And over the years, there have been a lot of people who've contributed. I'd like to mention Margaret Cheney, David Gisser, who died recently, Jennifer Mueller, and Samuel E. Sultanen, who will be speaking later. And a large number of collaborators and former students, some of whose CVs may cross your desk someday, so be kind to them. They're all very talented. So that's to emphasize it's not my work alone. This talk is meant to be something of an introduction to the afternoon session, which will go into much more technical details about the interesting problems in electrical impedance imaging, more mathematical and more technical. And so this is meant to be something of an introduction. So the main problem is, can we improve the diagnosis and treatment of disease, and I'm especially interested in heart disease and breast cancer, using electromagnetic fields? So there are some examples that we already heard a little bit about that you're familiar with. One would be the use of the electrocardiogram for diagnosing heart disease. And here, as we heard, in order for the heart to contract in an organized fashion, first a depolarization wave travels through the heart that initiates the contraction, and that difference in voltage between the top part of the heart and the bottom part of the heart produces currents that flow through the body. We're a very good conductor, like a bag of salt water. And that produces voltage differences on the body's surface that are reflective of the currents flowing through the heart. And those are measured by measuring the voltage difference on the body's surface. So that's an example of the use of electromagnetic fields for the diagnosis of heart disease. Very similar physics and electrophysiology to what goes on in the brain. It produces the electroencephalography, although the detailed physiology is very different for the depolarization of the nerves in the brain. All right. This is an example of the use of electromagnetic fields that you're familiar with, hopefully not personally, but maybe from watching TV. Some of you I know are personally familiar with this, treating heart disease. So when the heart goes into fibrillation, it's out of phase. The waves are not traveling through in an organized fashion, and it kind of shakes like a bowl of jelly. And the way to fix it is sort of like fixing a broken radio by taking it and whacking it. And you give 3,000 volts on two electrodes, every muscle in the body violently contracts, but more than 70% of the time, a regular rhythm is restored and life is restored. So from these two examples, you can see that in order to try to improve on being able to figure out what the voltages are on the surface of the heart, or the sources of current are within the heart from measurements on the body's surface, since the currents flow through the conducting material, one would like to know the conductivity of the lungs when they're filled with air, when they have blood in them. Similarly, in order to make a more efficient defibrillator, one needs to pass the currents efficiently to the regions of interest. You don't want to burn it up, but you want it to be high enough in energy to be effective. And so you need to know the electrical conductivity in order to make a more efficient defibrillator. So those were some of the original motivations behind the impedance imaging problem, why I got interested in it, and the clinical problem is to make clinically useful images of the electrical conductivity and the electrical permittivity inside the body from measurements made on the outside of the body. So there are many potential applications that have been tried, and I'll talk about monitoring heart and lung function continuously in real time. People have been looking at brains, trying to localize epileptic seizures. David Holder in University College London has done some of the pioneering work there. And I'm especially interested in breast cancer and improving the inverse problems in electrocardiography. So the reasons that impedance images can show you different tissues is that the conductivity there in Siemens per meter, and 1 over the conductivity is the resistivity in ohm centimeters, can be very different for a different tissue. In particular, blood is much more conductive than cardiac muscle, 150 ohm centimeters as opposed to 500 ohm centimeters. I love this pointer. Lung, as you can see, is much more resistive than cardiac muscle and blood, and as air goes in and out of the lung, it becomes more resistive and less resistive, more resistive and less resistive. Normal breast tissue is fairly resistive, and typical tumors can be as much as 6 times or even more conductive. So there's a high contrast in many tumors. So the procedure for imaging heart and lung function in three-dimensional electrical impedance tomography is fairly straightforward. Put some electrodes on the surface of the body, apply either currents or voltages, and measure, in this case we apply currents, we measure voltages, and reconstruct the conductivity sigma, and the permittivity epsilon, and omega denotes the angular frequency in radians per second, and get a picture out. This is an example of the only commercial system that was commercial for a while that was FDA approved to be used in diagnosing breast cancer by a company called T-Scan in Israel, and for a while the Siemens company was selling them. What they do is they have a little array of electrodes on what looks like an ultrasound probe that you can move around over the region of interest. They keep that at ground potential. All of them are at the same voltage with a voltage source. And then the right wrist, say, is at, if you're looking at the right wrist could be at 2 volts. So current flows from the wrist to each of the electrodes. And when you move over a uniform area, they just make a picture of the currents. And if the region underneath is all uniform in conductivity, all the currents are roughly the same. You get a uniform gray picture. And if you move over a tumor, that's a more highly conductive region, more current flows, and so they get a little white spot. And that's it. Very crude. It was an 8x8 array, so they're only looking at a 64-pixel image. It's not even a reconstruction. So the question is, does it work? And the reason it was approved, in order to test something, one typically does a clinical trial with a number of patients, and one measures the sensitivity, which is the number predicted to have cancer, divided by the total number that actually had cancer, and the specificity, that would be the number that were predicted not to have cancer, divided by the total number that do not have cancer, expressed as a percentage. And this is just some of the many numbers that were presented from blinded trials to the FDA by T-Scan. So when they looked, these were about 273 equivocal mammograms for those experts in the audience, BI-RADS 3 and 4. And they used mammography alone. These were scored blind. They got a sensitivity of 60%. And when they additionally scored the T-scan image, the sensitivity went up to 82%. So that meant roughly, if you were doing a diagnosis strictly on the basis of these scores, 22 out of 100 extra women who had cancer would have been detected by using the T-scan. Similarly, the specificity was 41% only with mammography and 57% when the T-scan was used adjunctively. These, again, were blinded readings. So that meant that 16 extra women might have been spared a biopsy who did not have cancer. if one trusted these numbers and acted on them. So the question is, of course, these aren't very good. Still a lot of people are being biopsied who don't have cancer, and there's a good number of cancers that are missed. So the question is, how can one increase the sensitivity and specificity? And of course, the answer is to use mathematics and electromagnetic theory to design systems to reconstruct and display the conductivity inside the body in three dimensions. So we'll begin with what are the equations. So we start with one of the greatest achievements of humankind, Maxwell's equations. So we have the curl of the magnetic field is the current density J plus the rate of change of the electric displacement. The curl of the electric field, I assume most of you are familiar with this. This is the one that says a current produces a magnetic field. This is the one that says a changing magnetic field produces an electric field. Okay. So I'll look for time-dependent, time-harmonic solutions. So we look for solutions of the form e to the I omega t in their time dependence. Oh, I should have checked that. Sorry. I didn't get that set right. All right. After one looks for time-harmonic solutions, that gets rid of the dispersive problem. So then the magnitudes of the currents that we apply are very low, so that linear constitutive relations are very good approximation to what goes on in the tissue. If you apply large currents, of course, you can defibrillate, so then things become nonlinear. But at low magnitude, we don't want anyone to feel anything, so we get that the displacement is the electric permittivity times the electric field, and the magnetic induction is the magnetic permeability times the magnetic field, and the definition of the conductivity is it's the current density divided by the electric field. So the current density is proportional to the electric field, and the constant of proportionality is the current density. It's also called Ohm's law. So if we look at the curl of H, that becomes sigma plus I omega epsilon E when we substitute the time harmonic solution, and the curl of E is minus I omega mu H. So if we take the divergence of the curl of H, we get 0, because the divergence of the curl is 0. So we get the divergence of sigma plus I omega epsilon E is 0. And we have the curl of E, as before, is minus I omega mu H. For simplicity, I will assume throughout this talk that the frequency is small enough that we can neglect it. So I'll assume omega is equal to 0 for the purpose of this lecture, although some of the images will have permittivity in them too. In that case, we have divergence sigma E is 0, and the curl of E is 0. Now, if the curl of something is 0, it's minus the gradient of a potential. So we have that the divergence of sigma times the gradient of the potential is 0 throughout the body. And that's our main equation that we'll talk about. The divergence of sigma grad U is 0 throughout the body. So here's the forward model. The divergence sigma grad U is 0 in the body. There's the body. And sigma du d nu, nu is the outward pointing unit normal, is the current density J on the surface. So the forward problem would be if we were given the conductivity sigma and given the current density J, find the voltage that would result on the body's surface or throughout the body, V, which is, I'll denote the potential on the body's surface by V. In other words, the forward problem would be to find the Neumann to Dirichlet map, which we'll denote by R of sigma J. It maps the current density or Neumann data to the potential or Dirichlet data, and it depends nonlinearly on the conductivity. Okay, so just a little notice, R maps H minus a half to H plus a half on the boundary, so it is a smoothing operator. So the inverse problem is we measure R of sigma. We apply lots of different currents, and we measure the voltages. So we measure this operator, R of sigma, the Neumann to Dirichlet map, and we'd like to find sigma, the conductivity. So that raises a lot of questions. So the first one, is it all possible? Is it possible to distinguish two different conductivity distributions, and this should have been sigma, from tau, for example? Say, a breast with a tumor from a breast without a tumor, a lung filled with air versus a lung empty of air. Can we distinguish them? Well, should we apply? So the answer to that is yes. You can, in theory, with infinite precision measurements, if you can measure everywhere. And that was proven. First, when the conductivities are close to a constant, in a beautiful paper by Alberto Calderon, then when the conductivity, this is in two or more dimensions, then by Bob Cohn and Michael Vogelius, if the conductivities are piecewise analytic, and then in a breakthrough in the field of inverse problems was this beautiful paper by John Sylvester and Gunther Ullmann, which you should all ask him about if you're not familiar with it later, in which they removed the criteria for piecewise analyticity just for smooth potentials, smooth conductivities. And then that was in three or higher dimensions. Two dimensions remained a problem for a while, and then Adrian Nachman gave a rigorous proof in two dimensions. And since my time is short, and I was hoping Gunther was going to give a talk about that, but afterwards, if you're interested in the ideas behind these different proofs, I would be happy to explain them to you in private or show them to you on the blackboard for anybody who doesn't know them, but I recommend you speak to Gunther. Go to the source. Okay. In any event, so then there's a question of practical design. In reality, we can only measure with finite precision and with finitely many electrodes. So in that case, the question is, can we still distinguish two different conductivity distributions? Is it still possible to detect a tumor of a given size with a reasonable measurement precision? Should we apply currents or voltages? We saw some people build current sources, other people build voltage sources. So the mathematics will suggest we should build current sources. Which patterns of currents should we apply? So those patterns that we should apply turn out to be the eigenfunctions of these Neumann de Dirichlet operator. And so there's an optimum set of patterns to apply. How many electrodes should we use? What size should the electrodes be? These questions can all be answered by studying the spectrum of the Neumann de Dirichlet map. And finally, how can we reconstruct images once we have good data? It doesn't matter how good your reconstruction algorithm is if the data that you have doesn't have any information about the tumor in it, whether it's there or not. If you can't distinguish it, no algorithm in the world can reconstruct it. So the question is, when the precision is finite, I claim that we should apply currents and measure voltages. And the reason is that the operator R of sigma is smoothing. So errors in electrode placement and in current sources would be smoothed out. You know, it's easier to solve the Neumann problem to get the voltage than to solve the Dirichlet problem and predict the normal derivative. The other way around is desmoothing. So if you build a set of voltage sources and put them on the boundary, small errors in placement or in the accuracy of your voltage source will be amplified and result in a noisier signal. Gunther, can you tell me? So that was at least that was the motivation why we built a system based on current sources. Can you just give me an idea of when I'm supposed to finish?
12:05.
12:05? Oh, okay. I have a lot of time. Okay. So then the question was, which currents should we apply in order to best distinguish different conductivities? In other words, what pattern of currents should we apply that would be able to detect the smallest tumor for a given precision of measurement? And I'd like to give you a little example to illustrate that. I guess I need to explain this. So the answer is that the best patterns are the eigenfunctions of the Neumann to Dirichlet map, and I'll explain why. So in order to explain why, let's define on the surface of the body an inner product. So just L2, we take the inner product of F and G is the integral over the surface of F of X times G of X dS, And then the norm denotes the norm in L2 on the surface. The norm of F squared is the inner product of F with F on the surface. And then we introduce the notion of the distinguishability of sigma from tau by a current density J. And that's so you can think of sigma as the heart filled with blood and tau as the heart empty of blood. And J is the applied current source. This is the measure of the distinguishability of these two different conductivity distributions, sigma and tau over J. And we just define it to be basically the difference in the voltages that you would get when sigma is inside. R of sigma J is the voltage you would get when sigma is inside and you apply the current density J, minus the voltage that one would get when tau is inside and you apply the current density J, divided by the norm of J. Okay. You can always get a bigger voltage difference just by making the current bigger and bigger and bigger. Unfortunately, at some point, the person starts to smoke. So we normalize here in order to get the shape of the pattern. And then, of course, we limit its amplitude so that people can't feel it. When you're looking at metals or oil flow or anything like that, you don't have those restrictions. But people complain, especially if you're doing a prostate exam. Okay. So... In order to find the best current density J to distinguish two different conductivity distributions, sigma and tau, we maximize the distinguishability over J. In other words, we choose the J that maximizes this is the square of the norm divided by the square of the norm of J. So you might recognize this immediately if we want to maximize that distinguishability squared. From Lord Rayleigh, that's the maximum of that quadratic form is exactly attained by those J's that are the eigenfunctions of R of sigma minus R of tau. In other words, rho, the largest value of the distinguishability, is the largest eigenvalue of the absolute value of this operator. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so the best current densities are those that are the eigenfunctions of this operator, and the largest value of the distinguishability you could ever have is the largest eigenvalue of this absolute value of that operator.
Looks like it should be rho minus S squared.
Yes, does it keep... I'm sorry, what does it say?
In the way you had it, it doesn't matter because R is self-adjoint, right?
That's correct.
So actually, the way
you had
it comes like it's the square of the eigenvalue.
Yes, the square, delta squared was, yes. So the maximum of this is attained by that J that satisfies this equation where rho, the largest value of this, is the largest eigenvalue of the absolute value of this operator.
And the maximum is rho squared.
The maximum of delta squared is rho squared.
No, it's delta because you have the delta has a rho squared. It has an R squared. Look at the previous slide.
Yeah, that's right. It's R squared. But that was delta squared on the previous slide. Oh. So I squared it in order to write it as an inner product, and I left out the square root. And when I tried rewriting everything last night in the wee hours, I discovered that my new computer and my new version of PowerPoint doesn't have the same fonts as what I had used before when I was in Italy the night before I was writing it in Italy. And so there are some... It's not as nice as it should be. I apologize. But yes, you're right. On some slides, it's the square and of the distinguishability, and on others, it's the absolute value of the distinguishability. And on some it's sigma, and on some it's rho because the fonts got messed up. Okay, so we say that so we can tell in theory if two conductivity distributions, say a tumor from a background, the sigma and tau are distinguishable by measurements of precision epsilon if and only if the maximum over J of the distinguishability is bigger than that measurement precision. In other words, if and only if this largest eigenvalue is bigger than the measurement precision. If this largest eigenvalue is less than the measurement precision, no measurement that you can make can ever tell the difference between sigma and tau.
Sigma tau fixed here.
last relation, sigma tau, fixed.
Yes, here sigma and tau are two fixed conductivity distributions. Say, yes. So, just as a practical question, we can ask what measurement precision do we need in order to detect a tumor of a given size? And is it reasonable to build such a system? Well, I can just draw a little example here. Okay, so I'll do a very simple example. Suppose we want to distinguish, let's say this is sigma 0 and sigma 1, just a circle. Imagine a cross-section of a body. This is the ordinary body, and here's our tumor. And this is sigma 0, and this has radius r sub 0, and this has radius r sub 1, this radius r sub 0. And we ask, what?
A constant, sigma 0, sigma 1.
Yes, that's correct. Just a very simple example. What precision do we need in order to be able to tell the difference between these two conductivity distributions? This would be sigma of p, and this would be tau of p. Right? So we can, in this example, you can use separation of variables to solve Laplace's equation very simply and work out and show that r of sigma minus r of tau times e to the I n theta. So if we introduce coordinates, this is a point r, this is theta, is going to be, let's call it, what did I call it above? Rho sub n e to the I n theta, n equals 1, and so forth. Where rho sub, so these are the best patterns of current density to apply. They're just sines and cosines. N equals 1, the rho n's, let's call them delta rho n's. Delta rho n's. So they would be r0 over sigma 0 n, 1, 2 mu gamma to the 2 n over 1 plus mu gamma to the 2 n, where mu is sigma 1 over sigma 0 minus 1 over sigma 1 over sigma 0 plus 1. So that's between 0 and 1, and just has to do with the contrast. And gamma is r1 over r0. So that's just the ratio of the radii. So we see that these distinguishabilities are decreasing as n increases, as the spatial frequency increases, the difference in voltages in magnitude decreases. And it's proportional to this, these eigenvalues that go down very rapidly. And the best one is with n equals 1. So the best one to apply would be e to the I theta, or cosine theta, or sine theta. And that would result in a uniform flow through here. And in that case, n is 1. We see roughly that the distinguishability is proportional to the area times the contrast. And in three dimensions, it's the volume times the contrast. So you can figure what's the size of the smallest object you can detect by setting this equal to the measurement precision. And then you can work out the area and volume that way. So you can figure out what precision you need. So on. Okay. And I can show more examples. So this is an example where we could work out in advance what the best current patterns were for what was inside the body. It was a very simple example. We could calculate it analytically. The question is, how do we find what the best current patterns are to distinguish between what's inside at two different states, say, the body at one time from the body at another time? Say, if you're looking at whether a tumor is being perfused or not, and you want to see when the blood is in the tumor and the blood is out of the tumor, you want to see what's the difference in the image in the region of interest in the breast between two different moments in the cardiac cycle. How would you find the pattern that best distinguishes between the states without knowing what's inside? So this is an example of, it's not a secret. That was supposed to be a joke, by the way. You're allowed to laugh or throw something. So the idea is very simple. We guess any conductivity, any current density, call it J0. Guess any current density whatsoever, and then we apply it. So by applying it, we measure R of sigma J0. These are just the voltages we get when we apply it. We measure that. We could compute or also measure R of tau J0. If we had some idea of what was inside, say a homogeneous background, we could compute this, or we could apply it at a different moment. And then we just calculate R of sigma J0, the measured voltage, minus R of sigma R of tau J0. And then we normalize it. And that's our new guess. And if the distinguishability doesn't change very much, or this vector doesn't change very much, say after doing this a few times, we will have achieved the maximum distinguishability. And if it's bigger than our noise level, we can distinguish them. If it's not, there's no way to distinguish it. Why does this converge? Anybody recognize immediately?
Power method.
Exactly, right. It's the power method for finding the eigenfunction with largest eigenvalue of this operator. So it's extremely simple. Okay. So we can find all of the currents by generalizing this. And then the question is, how many electrodes should we use? And I'd like to point out just one little fact. So the number of electrodes is determined by the measurement precision. The more precision, yes?
This process was with a fixed guessed tau, right? But how do you choose that?
Well, we start with depends on what you're trying to do. So if you want to distinguish what's inside from a homogeneous thing, say you guess what's inside is homogeneous, and you just want to get the best pattern to distinguish whatever is in there from your first guess. So you can start with one of them being homogeneous, and then the other being measured. Or you can take two. It depends on what you're looking. Suppose you want to look at the heart, and you want to see what is the best pattern to use to distinguish systole from diastole. So then you measure. One time you measure when the heart is filled, and then one time you measure when the heart is contracted, and you build the system fast enough so that you can do the adaptive process to distinguish between those two. And in fact, if you look at how tumors are frequently distinguished from other structures, you look at the uptake of blood by that lesion. And if you can go fast enough, you want to be able to distinguish the blood as it goes in and out of the region of interest. So from two different moments in the cardiac cycle. Okay, so I will skip this in order to... So the analysis of the spectrum of those operators suggests if you're going to put L electrodes on the body's surface, the question is, do you want to make them L small electrodes, like points, or do you want to make them space-filling? And the answer is space-filling. And if you want to know why, it comes out of the properties of those eigenfunctions, and I'd be happy to go into detail in private. Okay, so now how do we reconstruct useful images? So there are quite a few different algorithms, and a large number of people have come up with algorithms. They fall roughly into three categories. Linearization, you assume that the conductivity is roughly close to a constant or close to some known value and perturb off that. Optimization methods, these are typically iterative methods which one tries to minimize some form of error. And direct methods, these are non-iterative methods that use deeper ideas, such as those in inverse scattering theory, and in particular, if you come later to the afternoon session, you will hear some of the work of Samuel E. Siltanen, Jennifer Mueller, and Nuti Hayavin, and Kim Knudsen, some of them will be talking about the D-bar method, others will talk about other scattering methods. So I highly recommend, if you're interested in how very, very interesting mathematics can actually be used to make images from experimental data, come later. There's other ideas, layer stripping, which I won't go into. I'll just talk about the linearizations. All the images I'll show come from very simple linearizations, and these are some of the former students who wrote the codes that implemented these ideas. Steve Simsky did the 2D version, Peter Edick did a fast version of that, and Rusty Blue did a 3D fast version based on simple linearizations. These were their theses at RPI. Peter is now at GE, as is Rusty. Okay, so just to give you a quick idea, but we start with the conductivity that we don't know, and we apply a current density J super M, the mth current density that we apply. So we have divergence sigma grad UM is 0, and sigma DUM D nu is JM. Over here we start with a constant conductivity, or one that we know, sigma sub 0, and so this U sub 0 denotes the potential that we would get with this conductivity sigma sub 0. Well, let's imagine for the moment that it's a constant. So this one we can calculate because we know sigma 0. Okay, if we multiply the first equation by U sub 0 super N and multiply the second equation by U super M and subtract and integrate, and then we use Gazelowitz's formula. Oh, I'm sorry, Green, Gauss, Stokes. Those of you who are in the biomedical, there's a few people here who I see smiling who might. There is somebody who calls this Green's formula Gazelowitz's formula in the biomedical engineering literature. In any event, if we integrate, we notice by the divergence theorem, Ostrogradsky, I probably should mention Ostrogradsky also just for the. I probably haven't gotten everybody, but you can tell me the Japanese. Okay, so we integrate the divergence, and we get this term integrated over the surface. Notice here's the potential that we know times the applied current density. Here's the potential that we measure times the current density that we apply only in theory. And here we see we get a moment of the unknown difference between the conductivity we don't know and our constant. So we have a moment which is the gradient of the potential UM that we don't know and the gradient of the harmonic function U0N. So we get a weighted integral of the unknown.
Sigma 0 known?
Yes, sigma 0 is known. That's our guess for
sigma
what's inside.
Unknown.
Sigma is unknown. Exactly right.
U unknown.
U is unknown. That's correct.
Non-linear.
That's correct, nonlinear. And now, so we can rewrite the surface term this way, U0j, uj. And notice that's just equal to the inner product of jm with r of sigma minus r of sigma 0jn. So that's just data. We can write it as data of nm, just a set of numbers that we measure.
Unknown.
No, this we measure. Data we measure. Because it's a surface. This is the surface term. That we know. Right. This is the voltage on the surface. We measure it on the surface, so we know it. So this is known. This, we know the moments. This integral, this set of integrals we know. These numbers we know. We know these integrals. Yes?
If you use a space-filling electrode, how do you calibrate what the J is over the electrode?
Okay, so there's another issue. What is the actual, how do we connect this to measured data? And there are a number of models that describe, there's one called the complete model that describes how to go from the currents on a finite electrode to the current density. And if you will ask me that again or come to the session this afternoon, Nuti, you will discuss the complete model and how to go from the currents that are applied to the current density. So for the moment, let's just imagine the simplest possible model. Let's assume that the current density is equal to the current divided by the area of the electrode, and zero in the gaps. Okay, that's, we call that the Avgap model. Okay, so imagine that. With that, you can predict the measured values to between 10 and 20%. With the complete model, which is a little more complicated, you can calculate. We demonstrated that for metal against saline or for metal against metal, we can predict the measured voltages to within better than a tenth of a percent. So that was roughly the accuracy of the ACT II system. So in other words, the forward model enabled us to predict the current density so that we could reproduce the measurements to the precision we can measure with our ACT 2 system. So you can either ask me again later, I'm happy to talk about it, or come to the session this afternoon for a wonderful talk, I'm sure. Okay. So for the moment, let's just pretend that we know how to get the current densities. You can imagine it's the average of the current divided by the area. It's not completely correct, because it neglects some of the physics. Okay, so let's let delta sigma, that's our unknown, be sigma minus sigma zero, and let's assume that it's smaller than sigma zero. So this is the linearization. In that case, UM, the actual unknown potential, is a harmonic function plus a term that's of order delta sigma. Okay? So we assume delta sigma is small. So then our data, which is... Yeah, big O. Big O. So this is the integral of... The data that we know is the integral of delta sigma grad UM dot grad UN. So that's the integral of delta sigma grad U0M dot grad U0. And now we know both of these because they're harmonic functions, plus a term of order delta squared, which we will throw away. That's the linearization. And then we have known moments of the unknown conductivity.
Delta small, R sigma, no small.
Yes, this means delta sigma. This is delta sigma squared.
Okay. Sigma. Sigma large or small?
Delta sigma is small. Okay. Yes, another one of my many confusions. I apologize again. Okay. So we now get that our data that we know is equal to these weighted integrals. So we choose some basis. Psi k of x, I also spell excellently, and delta sigma is the sum of, so we assume that the conductivity is a linear combination of some known basis elements, say piecewise constants on some mesh, which is carefully chosen to give us the maximum ill-posedness in the reconstruction. That's a joke. Right? Okay. So that really makes a big difference, by the way, which basis you use. Big difference. Okay, so you plug that in here, and then we just get some matrix times the unknown is the data. We invert that matrix. We can do it very fast. And then finally, does it work? So we tested it by experiment. This is our third generation system whose results I'll show you briefly. There are 32 current sources because that was all the money we had. The theory said that the precision that we had would justify 128 electrodes per plane. But all we could get was enough money to build 32. So, and we have 32 current sources, 32 voltmeters, 32 electrodes. It operates at 30 kilohertz, actually 28.8 kilohertz, and makes 20 frames a second. And the precision with which the currents are applied and the voltages are read is better than 0.1%. For no matter what the load is, a reasonable human load as it varies, the currents are accurate to better than 0.1%. No, everything I'm going to show you is for heart and lungs, for chest. We're building the fourth generation system specifically for breast. If there's time, I'll show you a little bit. We haven't finished that yet. So this is a phantom just to show what can be done when you know exactly what's inside. This is the size of my chest, 30 centimeters in diameter. The heart and lungs are made of agar. You can put different amounts of salt in to make different conductivities. This is a reconstruction with a large heart and a reconstruction with a small heart of the resistivity, left lung smaller than right lung. The radiologists are going to be upset because it's upside down and backwards. Right? Anterior's down here. I'm sorry. Okay.
When you say 30 kilohertz, you mean 30,000 samples per second? Or?
No, the current that we apply is a sine wave at 30 kilohertz, and the amplitude, I'm sorry?
The duration.
We make 20 frames a second. Each frame, so in 1/20th of a second, we make one frame, and each picture, or one frame, requires 31 applications. So we, in 1/20th of a second, 1/30th, about 1/600th of a second is the time that it takes to apply the currents for one measurement. Okay, so this is also just another image of that. And I'm sorry.
It's not quantitative. You see that the
No, it's terrible. It's terrible, terrible. No, in fact, this problem is so ill-posed that it's doubtful that you would be able to make, under many circumstances, accurate conductivity reconstructions in any Sobolev norm. The question is, can you make a useful picture, let's call it in the physician norm? Can you see a tumor? Can you see a pulmonary embolism? Is it obvious that there's a pulmonary embolism? Is it obvious that there's a tumor there? Okay? That's not necessarily the same as making a good reconstruction in the Sobolev norm. However, if you come to this afternoon session, you will see how to do better using scattering theory. And Jennifer Mueller will give a wonderful talk about that.
Differences could be closer to quantitative. Differences between one state and another.
If they're close. Right, this is a linearization. Okay, so I'll come back this afternoon. But you're right, the values here are not good that I'm showing.
But you have a very easy thing that you are doing. That means you have a
very well, background. All right, why don't you keep... Okay. Yeah, no, it's a... Fine. All right, let me show you something that I think is hard. So here's what it looks like on a patient when in the ICU. Typically they're lying down. You can put... It takes about an hour to train a nurse to put these on a patient. You can leave them on for a week. And this is the picture I'm the most proud of. So this, for me, is hard. This is the difference between when the heart is filled with blood and when the heart is contracted. And actually, this is a permittivity image. This is omega epsilon. So what you see here is that the blood has gone out of the heart and into the lungs. Again, radiologists will be unhappy. This is the front, anterior. That's the back. This is the left lung smaller than right lung. And when you see the movie in real time, you'll see the blood going back and forth. This is the best picture I've ever made. I can make a lot worse pictures, especially on fat people. And so it's still a subject for research. But this is not easy to do, and we do this in real time. Well, let me show you. Remember, it's only a very low resolution image. It's 20 by 20. Okay, just to show you. So if you want to see what it looks like in real time, okay, I'm going to end in just, I said I had till 12:15. Okay. Now, another problem, I can't get the sound to work. So you'll have to bear with me. It's much better with sound. But there's a, so, and this is a very crude picture. This is one of our very first studies on a now famous GE employee. At one time, he was a graduate student, very talented young man. And he survived. He went on to have 2 children. They're healthy. And I was always the first chest subject, by the way. So, in any event, there are 32 electrodes on a little belt there. This was a very early version of our chest imaging system. First, concentrate over here, and what they're saying is breathe in, breathe out, take a deep breath. So it's, if you could hear it, it says take a deep breath, breathe out. Just look over here first. This one's going off scale. It's a difference image. Just look over here. Hold your breath right about there. Let it out. Now take a deep breath. Now hold it. Now let it out. As you, now you see the air going in and out of the lungs. That's what you see on patients. Okay, now over here, if you watch real closely at much faster on a different scale, you'll see when he holds his breath, the blood going from heart to lungs and heart to lungs back and forth again. Very low resolution. But if you watch carefully, you can see, hold your breath right about there. Ah, there it is. So you should be able to see the blood going back and forth. Very crude image, extremely crude. Okay. So in 3D, this is an example of, since we only had 32 electrodes, Here are four rings of eight. Notice they're big electrodes, not little electrodes, because that's what the theory says. This is one frame of a very coarse image. So these are four levels, about 10 by 10, extremely coarse. But here you see a high conductivity area, roughly where the heart is, and left lung smaller than right lung. And the radiologists in the audience can attest to the anatomical accuracy of this image. Okay. And its excellence, a 10 by 10 image. But anyway, you can see front back. And this was how we make the 3D images I'm about to show you. I'll skip through that. I get a minute. I can spin it around so you can, I'll skip that. I was going to spin it around so you can see what it looks like spinning around. This is a difference image, just showing air going in and out of the lungs in 3D. Two breaths. Breathe in, breathe out. So these are differences. All you're going to see is the changes due to respiration in the left lung and the right lung. This is going to be a cardiac sequence with two levels, and what you're going to see is a difference from when the heart was filled with blood. So as blood goes out of the heart, it'll turn blue, and the lungs will turn red, and then the heart will disappear again as it refills, and then it'll turn blue, and the lungs will turn red, if it works. So that's a very crude image. So the question is, can we improve the sensitivity and specificity in screening for breast cancer? And this is a certain mammography geometry with a few others. This shows that we can detect things twice as far away from the electrodes as the other systems that exist. So we still don't know. Happy to talk to anybody. And thank you all, especially, thank you all, but especially Gunther and John and people at PIMS. Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, one question. In fact, you present two different talks. One was an inverse problem, and the other one at the beginning was, what are the best signals to send to detect? How do you relate these two problems? Because in one case, you measure the complete matrix, and from this you, and in the other case, you just look what is the highest eigenvector of this matrix.
Right. So this is your fault, because you said, you asked this question, so I said, oh God, I've got to get it all in. So, but there really wasn't enough time to do what I had originally planned, so okay. So, in general, we measure all of the images I showed you today. All of the images are made with the eigenfunctions of the Neumann to Dirichlet map for the constant case. Now, I have lots of other examples to show what happens, but the ACT 3 system is a little too slow to use on people to do the adaptive process. So you can use it on tanks. I have examples with metal with cracks in it and with simulated heart lungs experiments where you can get the optimal patterns. Not just the best one. I only explained the best one. But as you know, you measure the whole matrix and you iterate the whole matrix to get the complete set of optimum patterns that give you the best ability to distinguish what's inside from a guess to the precision that you can measure. And you don't use any more. So after you find the best one, then you find the next best one. So you find the one that best distinguishes what's inside from your guess that's orthogonal to the first one. And then you look at the set that's orthogonal to that. Then you get, and you keep going until you can no longer distinguish what's inside from the guess. That gives you the basis, the J's, to use in the reconstruction algorithm. And then the reconstruction algorithm can be done adaptively with these patterns. So each time you improve the guess, you can then improve the basis. So does that...
Quick question.
Yeah, sort of a common follow-up question. If you showed me this method, I'd never heard of it before, and you said, we're going to do these reconstructions based on measurements made on a ring, and we're going to try and do a tomograph the way they do, a CT from a single set of projections in a plane, I'd tell you you're nuts because it's got to be multi, it's multi-path, it's out of the plane, it's non-rectilinear, you can't do it. I'd expect that your measurement scheme with detectors over areas would work. Why does it work with just detectors on a ring around the chest at all? Maybe this is okay. Scattering theory talk, but I just I don't understand that.
Well, I went through the linearization.
Yeah.
And so if you believe that grad u n dot grad u m, where u and u n and u m are any harmonic functions whatsoever, form a basis, then you should be able to believe that you can reconstruct the function delta sigma. Now, why don't we meet afterwards? This is exactly the lead-in to the Calderon idea and to Sylvester Ullmann work to show you how you can get the Fourier transform by choosing exactly the right harmonic functions. So by choosing the right harmonic functions, you can get the Fourier transform.
Just in the plane.
Just in the plane, right. Okay, so grad u dot grad u1 dot grad u2 can be e to the I x c dot p. So that's the magic. That was Calderon's idea. And if you believe that, but that basis is not a good one to use from a signal to noise point of view. It's great for reconstruction.
That's for an arbitrary boundary in the plane, you get the Fourier transform?
Yes.
For an arbitrary boundary in the plane?
Yes. 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 Or in three or in n dimensions, but n has to be bigger than two. Two or bigger. Okay.
Let's thank the speaker.